Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the session number 8 today. Today's session would complete the theme of enlightenment that we started 8 weeks ago. So today we would discuss the 10th and the last paramita, that is Upekkha. Upekkha, as you see on the board, this is the definition of Upekkha. It comes from the root iksh, I with the diacritical mark hyphen on top, K, S, and diacritic mark dot underneath S. S is pronounced as iksh. So, like television, iksh. It comes from the root iksh. And then you use the prefix upa, U-P-A, before the root iksh. Upa plus iksh, which means, and then the verb is ikkati, I-K-K-H-A-T-I, ikkati, to look on closely. To look on closely. So Upekkha, the general translation of which is equanimity, in fact means to look on closely, or to take a closer look on something. So that's what Upekkha means. So the general translation equanimity doesn't convey that meaning. That's why it's always important refer to the etymology of the term that we learn. So then again, Upekkha is derived from the root upa plus iksh, to look on closely. The prefix upa means together, in association with or closely. For example, my name also Upananda, who lives in the company of joy. Nanda. Nanda is joy. Upa means close. So the universal meaning of prefix upa is close. And also remember, we did talk about we came across the prefix upa somewhere else in our previous classes. Remember, we talked about three levels of paramitas: general, normal, higher and highest. So dana parami, dana upaparami, and dana paramatta. Paramatta means absolute practice. So the practice of dana to the maximum extent, meaning to sacrifice your life, where we talked about how Bodhisattva Maitreya sacrificed his life to a hungry tiger mother. So Bodhisattva Gautama sacrificed his life, and then so that when Bodhisattva Maitreya was a moment behind, so he couldn't make it. So as a result, Bodhisattva Gautama became the Buddha first. So Maitreya Buddha come, and there we talked about upaparami. So the dana is to share your earnings. What you make, what you earn for yourself, spend money for charity and stuff is dana parami. That's the normal that we all do our day-to-day life. If you donate something that is part of your body, that exists as part of yourself, as part of your self, means that's upapar. Upa means close to, in association with, in the company of. Upapara means to donate your limbs, like organ donations. That's why when you donate organs, and that donation of organs completes the second level of parami. That's why it's called upa. Upa. The whole point here is to describe what upa means. Upa means to, that is inseparably interconnected with your being, with yourself. Like in dana parami, dana upaparami is to donate your organs. See the point here? That's where we, yeah. So, huh?
Yes, to your body.
Body, yeah. And if you sacrifice your life, then that is dana paramattha. So the whole point is to describe what upa means. Now, look on. Now, when you look on, you are not part of a group. For example, let's say there's a group of children playing, and you are not part of the group. You are not monitoring them. You are not guiding them. You are not leading them. So, but you stay at a distance and watch, keep watching. You are simply an onlooker because you keep looking on. You looks on what's going on. So that is what upekkha means. You can create that scenario in your mind. So you're observing something from a distance. So you are looking on something. So that's what upekkha means. Upekkha is to look on, but closely. Now the tricky part of this is upekkha is one of the yet another difficult paramita, very difficult to practice, because there's a fine line between looking on and grabbing it, looking on and possessing it. Yes. Yeah, upadana, same. Yeah, upadana, yeah, exactly. Upadana, same. Yeah, remember we also just talk about dana, adana, upadana. Upadana means, you remember we talked about that. It's okay at all. Yeah, thank you for that question, because we can also refer back. Dana is giving, adana, grabbing towards yourself, are, and what you grab, keep for yourself as part of yourself, within yourself. That's upadana, and that's called clinging. Because of clinging, you keep something for yourself. That's why clinging. So even, let's say, if I fly overseas and I forget my phone here in London, now if the phone is not with me physically, but it's with me at the same time, it's not absent, it's present in my mind because of clinging to it, upadana. I carry it in my head wherever I go, even though I forgot it this time. So up until probably I have a deeper upadana, be deeper clinging to my phone in case I forget it somewhere. Why? And you got fear added to it. You add your insecurity, deep sense of insecurity added to your upadana, your sense of clinging, because you might wonder if you will get your phone back when you come back to London. And you create a lot of sankharas, so that lot of sankharas you create there of. That's this upadana. This upa means part of. Grab towards yourself and keep it for yourself. So now, yes, so there's a fine line between looking on and grabbing it or possessing it. For example, now this is my phone. Let's say when I look at that phone, now if I apply upekkha into my perception on your phone, I wouldn't create any. I wouldn't have any craving for it, but I'm simply observing your form. So it's neither pleasing nor it's neither satisfying nor dissatisfying. I just look at the phone. Yeah, it's just another phone. If I use a better analogy, now there's someone whom you hate, so that they are your opponents. And there are someone you love so much that not a moment would you like to miss their presence in your life. However, you in your day-to-day life, you meet people on the bus, on the train, the tube, in public places, but they are neutral. They are indifferent to you. You don't have any specific connection with them, negative or positive connection. If you have a negative connection, it should be with your opponent. If there's a positive connection, pleasing, and that should be the one that you like or love. Whereas everyone else that you see in public places, on the train, on the bus, etc., on the plane, etc., no. And to them, in your eyes, in your perception, they are indifferent to you. So that is the way. That is the way those who have upekkha would look at everything else, everything in their life. Upekkha. I think that is a better metaphor, better analogy. So, and then you are, in your perception, those objects or people are indifferent to you. And you don't have specific affiliation, negative affiliation or negative affliction or positive affliction. Sorry, negative affiliation or positive affiliation. Because affliction has a negative connotation anyway. So you are not affected. You don't get affected by what you perceive when you have upekkha. Because you simply look on. You never become part of what you are seeing. You maintain a distance and you observe. That's why upekkha means. See, equanimity is the best translation. But layman's translation, later on we will come up with some few more translations as well. However, it's the best translation. However, it doesn't convey the meaning that original word conveys. Upekkha. It requires some description. So that's why I always personally, I always love to analyze terms and get the best. In a way that in so doing, I'm very careful too, because I am not supposed to distort the meaning. But most of the time, if you simply stick to the general translation, probably you might end up distorting the idea. So that's what happened a lot. It's called in sugar-coated Buddha Dhamma. Sometimes some people it's called sugar-coated. There's a candy. One child once told me that is the candy Buddhism, like candy. So that a candy comes with it comes in different colors, like lozenges. That I remember when I go to back my school days, lozenges they came with they would come with different colors, multicolored strips, so that we will always get our tongue colored, pink, red, green, etc. So that's called sugar coated. Sometimes, when you refer to certain books, some writers only write in a way that they only plant a sense of fascination in the reader's mind. So that well, because a lot of readers wouldn't like to face the reality. I know some of my students in the past, they fell out me sometimes because they really tried there to get me, convince them that Nirvana is something fascinating. When I said that, and then the thing they again and again they asked me to confirm that Nirvana is way better than heaven, because you'll be there permanently enjoying all the comfort, the best comfort. You will never lose it. When I say that with reference to a dialogue between Venerable Sariputta and another monk, in which the monk at Venerable Sariputta that said that he was not kind of disappointed that Buddha has explained Nirvana as of which you don't have to that he you don't have to enjoy anything thereof, and that to which Venerable Sariputta answered that Nirvana is fascinating is because there's nothing to enjoy in it. Because if you enjoy, then again you end up in suffering, because you can retain the feeling of enjoyment. It's not real. It's timed. Enjoyment is time restricted. When it's gone, when you are done with the experience, the only way to re-experience is that you rekindle your memory and then relive your memory. But still, it's not as real as when you re-experience it. That's why that monk was upset, kind of upset. Now, so when it comes to, so that's how it has to be realistic. That's why some followers, some people don't like to listen to a statement by the Buddha that everything is subject to change. And then sometimes recently I had one argument with one mathematician, so that he had a lot of he had gone through so much trauma in his life when I talked about Upekkha with him. So and then he told me that he was upset that Buddha didn't teach something that would make him happy. Then I told him, well, there are so many people who are extremely happy about the Buddha's teachings. I said that I'm happy. Then he asked why. I said, in the past I had a very critical medical history. I have been ill for many years and on and off. Then I went for medical treatments for weeks, for months, surgeries and all these things, fractured legs, fractured arms and different things. So then I told him, then I told him that I would always face the reality. First, I would have, it would bring me some insecurity. Insecurity, by the way, is a subtle form of fear. Then I said I would meditate on that. Then I would say every time I felt that, every time I had the insecurity due to my illness, and it worsens, it would worsen my pains. Then I told him that when I removed that insecurity from my mind, there was still pain, but that was actual level of pain. The pain as it was, as it is, not intensified pain, because I would otherwise get my pain intensified by adding insecurity on top of it. Then he got it. Then I said, okay, don't think about Nirvana right now. Being a monk, I don't think about it either. I live the moment. Live the moment, face the moment, and accept it. So everything is like a moment. And I told you, life is like a garland of flowers. And then you keep adding flower by flower by flower on the string. So this to the thread or the string. So the string runs through the garland. And you only see the garland, but not the string. But it is the string that keep the flowers intact. So that is when you see the garland there. Then I told him, so the reality is like the string. And at the same time, so when you feel, when the string is weaker, so the garland wouldn't stay intact. So that you have to have the strong, maybe nylon or something strong, the string that runs through the flowers, so that it can stay intact. So that's when you see it is stable. Then I told him, he thought about a lot, and then I asked him, okay, don't think about Nirvana about right now, sir. Meditate on your pain, meditate on your divorce, so and all that. So it now then he feels better. He feels better. So that's when then I asked him to, but now he has a fair understanding of Upekkha, how to look on without being part of what he sees. But that's where I feel critical. This is the fine line. We always, even a meditator who has been meditating for like 8 years, might get deluded by one of the how to say neutral attachment. Some people in one of the another themes is going to be the masquerading tendencies. I think in different countries I taught that series of masquerading tendencies. It's a long theme. So in when we talk about in when we talked about that theme, we will discuss one so the masquerading tendencies in depth. A masquerading tendency means a tendency, an inner tendency, a mental tendency that makes you feel, for example, that you are honestly you honestly have saddha, saddha, or rational faith in the Buddha. You honestly feel that you are having saddha, but in fact you are you don't you are not having saddha. You are simply fascinated by the Buddha's beauty. If I get better, then I a lot of monks, I know a lot of lay people in Sri Lanka. They simply attend the monks chanting or sermons because the monks is very attractive. To them, it is saddha or religious devotion, but in fact it is raga, so it is lustful feelings. But you can put the blame on yourself. Why? You don't know that what's going on in your head. To you, honestly, it is not raga. It's not sexual feeling, sexual. It's honestly to it saddha or devotion. It takes some time for you to understand that, in fact, when you hear the monk is now say he can preach like before, he can teach like before, and he rarely appears in public, and so that you are worried and you can see the monk. This actual experience, I had a lot of case studies. Then all of a sudden you come to know that the monk got a cancer on his face, and the part of his face had to be removed, and so that it would be scary to look at him, and the people would stop coming to him. I mean, those who have that masquerading tendency, because to them, the monk's physical appearance isn't pleasing anymore. His physical appearance doesn't please them anymore. So that those people who are fascinated by his appearance and who were mistaken as to the fact that they were not having saddha but lustful feelings toward the monk, and that's when some of them would understand. That's called masquerading tendencies of the mind, deceptive tendencies, if I use a better term, deceptive. So when it comes to upekkha is one such potential. It's an ability actually, that you may very easily get mistaken as to the fact that it is a neutral attachment. Attachment is supposed to be fascinating in our perception. However, remember we did talk about our identity. We are made of attachment, sattva, attachment. So attachment is part of our identity. So we can define ourselves without attachments. Without attachment, you can define yourself. So then. However, when it comes to our inner nature, our identity, as we try to practice upekkha on something, we might end up having what is called neutral attachment. A lot of spiritual people have that. New attachment means it is attachment. It's neither satisfying nor unsatisfying. It's neutral feeling, but still there's a fine line between that neutral attachment and upekkha. It's not upekkha yet. Why? On the surface level it looks neutral, but underneath it is not. So it is simply it is the attachment that is how to say, spiritually suppressed through meditation. So that's why a lot of highly well-known meditators and teachers, they fall from their upekkha. Sometimes they become, there are a lot of stories reported from around the world, some high-ranking meditators, and they get into a trouble with the woman or a financial, transactions and all of a sudden, so that they fall from their sainthood overnight. That's how upekkha is. Upekkha is very difficult. It's one of the ways to go. So the neutral attachment is not upekkha. Still, it is a fake manifestation of upekkha. fake manifestation of upekkha or equanimity. And people, those who have that, wouldn't notice it. It's one of the more subtle, deceptive tendencies or masquerading tendencies. Now, so, and another translation of upekkha is, and that would make more sense, 0 point between joy and sorrow. When I got the definition, I remembered him because your name. Zero. So you are zero. At zero, everything begins at zero, actually. So zero, you can go back to zero, or you can restart everything from zero. So that's when emptiness. Emptiness is always, I think we did talk about that one day in a meditation session, right? And somebody brought up that question. So when he talked about emptiness, zero. So 0 point between joy and sorrow. Now, zero, why we call 0 point, it's not something negative. It's not something passive. Because zero is neither positive nor negative, neither wholesome nor unwholesome. No satisfying, neither satisfying nor unsatisfying. So it's the point, it's the starting point. Now that is the closest thing to emptiness. Again, we talked about the problem, the ambiguity of the term emptiness, because in English language, emptiness has a negative connotation. My life is empty. The world is empty. I feel empty. So that is when the 0 point. Now, so this one, you can meditate. You can experience the 0 point in your meditation. It only lasts like a moment. In a split of a second, it's gone. I think some people talked about their experience. And that comes from upekkha. If you keep meditating in your meditation, at the beginning, basically it's the highest percentage of negative or heavy feelings, burdensome feelings. As you keep dissolving those feelings, and later, all of a sudden you feel relaxed and there's a happy feeling arising. And then you dissolve that also. You don't get attached to that happy feeling either. So then what happens is, and you continue to feel something, there's a feeling, there's an unqualified feeling. That is the zero feeling. You then for a split of a second, maybe during in a nanosecond, that moment, that feeling only lasts a nanosecond or less than that. We used a Buddhist word, K-H-A-N-A, the right little mark dot underneath N, Kana, or the Sanskrit word, that is K-S dot underneath, okay, so I made a mistake. Yes, yeah, K-S dot diacritical mark S underneath S H A N dot diacritical mark dot underneath N A Kshana. Kana is Pali, Kshana is Sanskrit. Moment, yeah. So the moment is actually, it is less than a nanosecond. I think recently I forgot that there's another further breakdown of the nanosecond also. I forgot those English words. Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, so but still, Kshana is less than that. Kshana is less than that. Now, it's not based on the time, actually. It's based on the speed of the mind, not the speed of the time. Kshana. So the mental speed is the mind is faster than time. That's where the problem is. So Kshana, within Kshana or within a Kana, less, but in, conventionally, we would call it maybe a nanosecond or so. In a split of a second, So that moment appears, that feeling, that experience, that's the correct word. You experience that, and that experience is gone the next moment. Even before you have noticed what it is, it's gone. And always you meditate, you define the reflection, you reflect on that experience because it's gone. It comes and it goes so quick that it never happened. That's how fast it is. Now that is the zero, but you can expand it. But the thing you cannot keep that zero point between joy and zero at all times. So that it is based on your focus. It is focus based experience. Let's say when you are enjoying, enjoying the tea. And so that you really enjoy when you take the sip and you enjoy the tea. When you take few sips and later you think that there's a better tea, or this tea is way better, or this tea is much worse than the tea that I had this morning, then we are back to our typical relative experience. We always relate the present moment with our past moments. So then again you become dualistic. Then your experience becomes dualistic. Whereas when you experience the zero point, it's not dual, it's beyond duality. Why? It's absent of joy and sorrow. It's completely devoid of joy and sorrow. So that is what zero point between joy and sorrow. This can be experienced in meditation, but not necessarily. A lot of people experience that when they are doing something, all of a sudden they experience that. But based on the past life experience, based on your mental fitness also. Now the psychologists use one word, and then that word came into existence, came into use maybe 3-4 years ago, mental toughness. Mental tough. That's a good book also. I purchased that book like 4 years ago in an airport, maybe somewhere when I fly in, maybe in Florida, or I bought that book, mental toughness. Otherwise, the word toughness used to have a negative connotation. But as a technical term, mental toughness means you don't get moved by, shaken by, moved by negative and or positive experiences. And it is considered one of the characteristics of leadership of a mindfulness trainer, life coach. So that's written by a life coach or a mindfulness trainer, mental toughness. Because you are not supposed to, in your leadership, you are not supposed to get moved by your clients. You can run your business. When you're too lenient towards your employees who are lazy, but at the same time you have to be very cautious about the brainy employees, that you work with. Sometimes when you are too satisfied with someone, then they might become a troublemaker to you, right? When you are too close to someone, or maybe you are too distant from someone. In both situations, that's dualistic. Whereas in meditation, as social beings, we need the zero point approach in our day to day life. However, due to our subjective nature, we can practice that at all the time. So that's when it is recommended we experience in the meditation or in your deep thinking, analytical thinking. When you are not meditating, you choose two favorite situations, one negative and one positive, and then you analyze them. That's called the Vipassana approach, as we always say, Vipassana. Vipassana approach is psychoanalytic approach. Right? Psychoanalytic approach. And that's when recently one of the Canadian mindfulness teachers told me that if Sigmund Freud knew what mindfulness was, and he would have come up with a different kind of psychoanalysis. However, Carl Jung was able to do that because he was more like a spiritual person. So zero point. So I personally like this definition: the zero point between joy and sorrow. Remember we talked about the neutral attachment. Now again, that's so the probably you can better you can choose zero point between joy and sorrow and equanimity and neutral attachment to compare to see the time to see the fine line. See, there's almost no difference between zero point and neutral attachment. But anyway, even though it's neutral, it is attachment. It is attachment. Like we talked about ice cream and Angina, and everyone always reminds me. And then, however, now it has become kind of a talk of the town nowadays. So I also use that because it's based on my experience, probably. So now. Non-attachment. We talked about non-attachment. Now, attachment and detachment are dualistic. If you use the zero point here, when you apply, when you replace joy and sorrow with attachment and detachment, like then zero point between joy, not joy, but attachment. Joy is attachment, and sorrow detachment. So attachment. That you are detached means you are thinking about the ice cream that is missing. You don't have access to it, but you are in your mind. You think about, you even dream about it, and in your dreams, ice cream, and so that you dive deep into an ocean of ice cream, and when you get to the sea floor, you will see the multicolored. So that's where the ice cream is. I have worked with children who had ice cream dreams about ice cream, candy, all that. So that's how we also have when we go back to our childhood sometimes, right? We still stick to our childhood attachments, childhood sankharas. We get motivated by childhood. When I worked with Alzheimer's, the dementia patients, as a volunteer work in the States, I noticed that too. They would only talk about, they forgot, they would easily forget what they ate this morning. But they would remember very well what they experienced like 80 years ago, 75 years ago, 100 years ago, they still remember. So, and then that's how there are certain things that we are, certain imprints of experience that are deeply printed onto our subliminal mind, consciousness, so that they come to the surface level of our consciousness, we get them rekindled, and they direct us again. They help us redefine our childhood, redefine our life now as it is right now. So now the next thing is, so that's about zero point between joy and sorrow, between ice cream and no ice cream. Ice cream and no ice cream are dualistic, whereas zero point between, how to say, with no reference to ice cream, it doesn't matter then. There's no ice cream whatsoever because you don't talk about it. It doesn't matter. It's nothing. It's not applicable to you. So there's no, it's not dualistic then. It's non-attachment. Attachment is not there, so it's none. So next one is, there's a popular definition, you know, in Abhidharma, in general Buddha Dhamma, you especially in the Satipatthana Sutra, in the four teaching on the, in the discourse on the four foundations of mindfulness. Vedanānupassana, foundation of sensations or feelings, is one of the four foundations. Now, Vedana is defined as sukha, dukkha,
and adukamasuka. Sukha is happy sensations or feelings. Dukkha is unhappy sensations or feeling. Adukamasuka, adukka asuka, adukka, feelings that is neither dukkha nor neither happy joy, happiness nor unhappiness, neither sukha nor dukkha. Now that is the definition. Why I am saying this is, I have come across some teachers who call the third one, I think let's look at those three terms on the board because this is something very critical. Now in the Satipatthana Sutra, you come across the mention of Vedana Anupassana, V-E-D-A-N-A, Vedana. This is one of the four foundations. Vedana means feeling or sensation. So Vedana is threefold. Sukha, that is happy, S-U-K-H-A, Sukha. And then Dukkha, D-U-K-K-H-A, Dukkha. Sukha and Dukkha, we have defined these terms multiple times. And so another one is, now the third one is Adukkha Masukha. Like so many words. That means Adukkha, A plus Dukkha. A plus Dukkha, then A plus Sukha. Adukkha means no Sukha, no Dukkha, no suffering, no sadness. Asukha means no joy, no happiness. So Sukha Vedana, happy feeling. Dukkha Vedana, unhappy feelings. Adukkama Sukha Vedana, feeling that is neither happy nor unhappy. So that's the definition. But the whole point here is, some teachers call it Upekkha Vedana. That's the wrong application. We have a lot of dialogues with different teachers. Some teachers are now in the middle of correcting them. I ask them, okay, we need to rewrite all this. So now, when you say Adukkha Masukha, a feeling that is neither. So we are now comparing Adukkha Masukha Vedana, feeling that is neither happy nor unhappy or neutral. Neutral or both. Now, the better translation of Adukkha Masukha is mixed feelings. Mixed. When you say Adukkha Masukha, it is still a mixture of both. So it could be more joy and less sadness. It could be less sadness or more joy. Adukamasuka. So if you some you always feel something. The only difference is that it is not completely dukkha vedana or completely sukha vedana. It's neither. Yeah, that's the so when you say neither of means at the same time a little bit of what is implied is maybe a bit of both. And the better one is not the neutral one. You can still call neutral. It's neutral because neither vedana, neither feeling is able to give you something that you really feel. It's not a deep happiness. It's not deep sadness. It's a mixture of both. And it's a very subtle one, reflective. So Adukkha Masukha Vedana. What it happens is, both cannot arise at the same time, but they arise so quick, so fast that you feel like they are appearing at the they pop up at the same time.
So that's no. Whereas, so and some scholars call it upekkha vedana, which is wrong, because in upekkha, it cannot be called upekkha or feelings of equanimity. Why? Because upekkha is to get away from happy feelings and sad feelings, or the neutral feelings, or the feeling that is neither sukha nor dukkha or mixed. And then, so upekkha, there's nothing called upekkha vedana. There's no upekkha vedana. Upekkha is an ability. Upekkha is a built-in ability, innate ability to observe both, observe upekkha, sukha, dukkha, and adukkhamasukha, all the three things. Now, this is one of the very subtle definitions. So, in case, if you call the third kind of vedana adukkhamasukha, upekkha, then what happens is, you wouldn't be able to. So that when you stick to adukkha, when you believe, let's say, for the moment, let's say, adukkhamasukha also means upekkha. If it is upekkha, then what happens is you become part of your feelings. Become part of the only difference is you don't know whether it's a clearly sukha vedana, sukha feeling, or the adukkha feeling. Maybe the feeling is kind of confusing, or the kind of mixed. It looks neutral too. Yeah, you can understand that adukkha masukha. So that is when some scholars, and I always have this, I say, no, it has to be upekkha. Upekkha vedana. So there's nothing called upekkha vedana. Upekkha is the zero point. Now, at zero, adukkhamasukha cannot be at zero. So it is that the feeling that is neither sukha or no dukkha, or a feeling that is neutral, the feeling that brings you confusion. So it cannot be at zero, because zero means devoid of all these three kinds of feeling, zero. But again, zero is the closest, but you still, zero is a kind of feeling too, right? So according to neuroscience also, you cannot experience unless you feel. You have to feel, but that feeling doesn't move you. You don't get moved by that feeling. Zero, upekkha, you don't get moved by upekkha. You stand still. And that is when, let's say, arahats, so the enlightened, it is said that arahats say, when they are ill, and they would say, this is how they would describe their pain. They would say, well, my body is suffering, my mind is at peace. My body is ill and is suffering, and my mind is at peace. They don't grasp it. They don't get attached, but they feel it. They feel the pain, but they don't get moved by that. Now, when Buddha was sick, according to those sutras, Chunda Thera Bodhchanga, in which when Buddha was ill, and according to Mahakasapa Thera Bodhchanga, when Mahakasapa was ill, and in the Moggallana Thera Bodhchanga, when Moggallana was ill, they were all arahats and enlightened ones, and Buddha himself too. And so that they would do it. What Venerable Ananda did was, and Venerable Ananda would walk to them, go to them men, and say that, and they would remind how they experienced upekkha, how they experienced enlightenment, the moment they became fully devoid of all these vedanas, sukha, dukkha, and adukkhamasukha. But this is what happened. Now they still have to listen to their body. That's the reason, because they can't. Now, when you are enlightened and you are ill, you are sick, and you feel some pains in your body, intense pain, and your mind is not affected by that. But however, you need to get your body cured. Why? Because for an ethical reason, because you will continue to teach the world, help the world until your death, so that you have to listen to your body, because without body you can't exist. So the Arahat would still go for treatments for their body, but not for their mind. The pains due to illness is actual pain, whereas in my case there are more fake layers of pain that I add, because I keep adding on. I add my fear on. I add my fear. I add my insecurity. I would add my anger. I would add my joy in the future. When I recover, I'll be happy like that. So I would imagination and all that. So that is when I get my pains intensified. So that while my body is ill, my mind is not at peace either. Whereas in the case of enlightened ones, even if their body is ill and their mind is at, because they live in upekkha. They have upekkha, they look at their pains through upekkha. So that's when there's nothing called upekkha vedana, there's sukha vedana. Probably because I went too far, there's pain in, because unless you have come across adukkama sukha and upekkha, that debate on that, it might not make sense hereafter. In case when you come up with that word sukha vedana, dukkha vedana, and upekkha vedana, and then upekkha, there's nothing called upekkha, cannot be vedana. It has to be adukkama sukha. It's a mixture of both or neither. Neither means it's so subtle that you don't understand that. It's not the fact that the pain is vedana is absent. It's there, it's too subtle. So, and then you will see, okay, this is upekkha. Upekkha is looking on from a distance, and you observe all your pains, upekkha vedana. Now the next one is Brahma, upekkha sambojjhanga, or another zero point. Some scholars define zero point with a different another term, hedonic neutrality. Hedonic neutrality. So it's neutral, but hedonic means involved in pleasure. Hedonic neutrality, but it is not so good a term. I personally prefer zero point. So the hedonic neutrality, and it makes sense too. It's neutrality, it's neutralism. Hedonic means it involves pleasure. You are happy. You are happy, but your happiness is neutral. That's the problem with the language. Enlightenment is ineffable. Ineffable. You cannot express enlightenment, fear, experience of enlightenment by words. They call it ineffable. And you can read I think that is the best book by Professor Asanga Tilakaratna. He's a Sri Lankan scholar, and he did his PhD in the University of Hawaii. His doctoral thesis is Nirvana and Ineffability. So ineffability, ineffable. You can't express. Unexpressible, inexpressible. You can't express your enlightenment. Ineffable. So that is, it is a feeling. You can't, the problem is, and he explained that he's a semantic scholar. I also like semantics. I love semantics. So he's a semantic scholar too. He explains how far language is successful, or how far language can, how fails or successful in defining. In describing the experience of enlightenment, but it wouldn't be that easy to dismiss. So that is why these scholars come up with these different translations. So hedonic neutrality is a good word, but personally, I like zero point between joy and sorrow. And then the next thing is upekkha is also one of the sambojjhangas. Remember we talked about bojjhanga the last time, we described bojjhanga, constituents of enlightenment. Pre-enlightenment, there are seven pre-enlightenment, they are called the seven precursors to enlightenment. So that you experience just before your enlightenment, you set your mind in these, you practice these bojjhangas. Bodhi, and we remember we defined that word, right? Bodhanga, Bodhi, B-O-D-H-I, Bodhi, plus A-N-G-A, Anga. Seven Bodhangas. Of course, there are 36 Bodhanga, 36 Bodhipakkhiya Dhamma. Remember, we have so far referred to Venerable Thanissaro Bhikkhu's book a lot, Wings to Awakening. There are 37 factors of enlightenment. And out of the 37, there are seven most important factors. They are called the seven Bodhangas. You can start your practice with any of those 37, 36. But however, when you advance in your meditation, you need to practice these seven, one or two or three or four or five or six or all the seven Bodhangas. Upekkha is the last one. Now, so it's no time to provide them. You can see when you refer to the seven Bodhangas, you'll say one of them is Dhamma Vichaya, for example. Investigation of Dhamma, Piti, rapture. So, whereas the first six Bodhangas comes from our innate positive, wholesome feelings. Where the last one, Upekkha, is way different than the first six. Why? In Upekkha, when you practice the last one, Upekkha, you don't have any piti. For a piti, sambojjanga is the bojjanga of the rapture. Now, clearly, it is a feeling. You feel it, rapture. You feel it in your body. You feel it emotionally. You feel it in your physical body as well. Whereas the last one, upekkha, it is the highest one of all these seven. Because I can't pull out the list from the phone right now, because I'm recording in case I turn off the airplane mode, then so that it would bother, it would impede my recording. Now, later you can Google for that and see the seven Bodhangas, and you will see the list and compare all the first six with the last one, and you will see the last one is very different. When you go by one of the first six, you will see that you can feel it. For example, Samadhi also feels stillness, you feel. But at Upekkha, you don't feel anything. But there's a feeling, and that feeling is called unqualified feeling. It's not a qualified feeling. Qualified. So that's Upekkha, the last of the seven factors of enlightenment, the seven highest factors of enlightenment that we need to practice. Before enlightenment, if you experience, then they are called pre-enlightenment experience. Seven pre-enlightenment experiences, of which last one would give you a deep sense of zero. And after that, next thing would be the enlightenment. So this is Bodhangas, and Buddha highly recommends that we practice at least one of these seven Bodhangas, because they are the direct. If enlightenment is a palace, and there are seven doors. Just one particular door is not colorful, so that you don't see the floral designs on the door frame. No floral designs. No. It's not embedded with precious stones or gems or diamonds, and then every other doors are kind of little bit colorful. Where in case you enter from the Upekkha door, it's like very plain, very austere. So that's Upekkha is the hardest one to practice, because at Upekkha your feelings are not qualified. So that's one of the Sambodhjanga, because we will discuss the Sambodhjangas in our future themes, under future themes anyway. And there'll be a lot of repetitions too. There'll be a lot of redundancy of terms. So, and next one is Brahma Vihara. We also talk about Brahma Viharas, and the last time we did talk about, right, four divine abodes, four divine abidings, how you can become a kind of, can experience divinity in human body. Historically, you also need to look at the Brahma Vihara from a historical point of view. Why? Because Buddha was born in India, and the highest reality that people would talk about, people would believe, the Brahman divinity. So you have to go upon death. So the Brahma Sahavyata in Sanskrit. Do you know, you want me to learn that word on the board? No need, right? Brahma Sahavyata. Brahma. Brahma. Sahavyata. Brahma Sahavyata. Union with God. Union with Brahman. Brahman is the Hindu word for God, the creator. Brahma Sahavyata. So, now, Buddha's interpretations and Buddha's teaching was so fascinating that he would never directly counter all already existing religions of the land. Instead, he would simply redefine certain terms because he had to borrow the same terms, and he had to redefine them. And that's when Buddha said, so instead of saying that you have to go to Brahma, and Buddha said that during your human existence, you can experience Brahma if you practice metta, loving kindness, karuna, metta, universal friendship, karuna, compassion, mudita, altruism, or happy joy in other people's achievements or success, and upekkha, equanimity. So when you practice them, that is the path to divinity within humanity. That was Buddha's definition. That's why Buddha was a very popular person. Now, he would never hurt anyone's feelings. He wasn't supposed to do that. He wouldn't do that, because enlightened person, people don't do that. Because enlightened mind is free from biases. So that is why Upananda has a long way to go to remove, to get rid of his biases. This guy, this monk. So working on that, I work on them on daily basis. When I remove one bias, there come another one in the garb of something fascinating. Aha. Yeah, you don't worry about that. It's not a bias. And I would tell my bias, no, I don't trust you anymore. The last time you put me in trouble. Okay, bias, don't come to me anymore. If you come, but I would, you wouldn't be able to get me the next time. So yeah, I'm an inner dialogue, a dialogue with my own mind. So that's called Brahma Vihara. Next one is two more terms we have to explain. Upekkha Sati Parisuddhi. May I erase this? There are two more terms to explain before we end the class today. Upekkha Sati Parisuddhi. Upekkha. UPEKKHA long A upekkha dash SATI sati dash, because this is one word, supposed to be one word, but so I separate PA long A RI SUDDHI parisuddhi. Upekkha sati parisuddhi. Now here, and we already know the meaning of upekkha. Sati is mindfulness. Parisuddhi is purity. Upekkha sati parisuddhi. Purity of mindfulness, which comes of 0 point between joy and sorrow. Let me repeat. I'll repeat several times until you write it down. Let me say that in slow. Purity of mindfulness, which comes of 0 point between joy and sorrow. Purity of mindfulness, which comes of 0 point between joy and sorrow. This is the most, this is the simplest way I was able to define it, break it down. See the upekkha satipatthisuddhi. Now, we put mindfulness, as we put mind, we put our mind fully into our aware, fully into what we are experiencing. But we might get, even though we want to have pure mindfulness, we might get our mindfulness. So even though our mindfulness is a pure approach, however, based on the experience, when we put our mind into fully into what we are experiencing, so now the experience, then in return can contaminate, can adulterate the purity of our mindfulness. That's what it happens. So in good faith, that we trust ourselves and we are going to experience something. Now, once we have experienced, we either feel happy or sad. Then what happens is, so before experiencing, your mindfulness was pure. But after having experienced mind, what you experience, and then so, your mindfulness cannot be shaken for it. Like say, okay, I really wanted to know whether this is good to experience it, and so somehow, this is what happens. It next time you are going to experience it, maybe you will, your mindfulness will maybe a little bit of how to say, endowed with hate or excitement or joy. So, and that is, and but it always happens to us. For example, you walk to a meditation class the first time, and all the first time you enjoy it. Okay, it's mindfulness. Okay, it really helped me because I had been looking for such a class. And then halfway through, okay, you enjoy the first day. Second day, what happens is you are tired or maybe restless. At the same time, the teaching is not appealing, so that the guidance are not clear, guidelines are not clear. So as a result, then you will continue to practice, but the mind, so that day, the second day, your mindful practice doesn't make any sense. It makes sense, but a negative sense. Then you are having seconds as to permanently walk away from this to class, or probably you will take a break from the, this, I wouldn't fit in here, so I wouldn't come again. And those actual experience that people share, I mean, so based on people's feedback. So now at that point, what happens is, when it comes to upekkha satipatthisuddhi, now your mindfulness is based on upekkha, based on 0 point. So there are no, there's no preconceived notions, preconceived ideas of what you are going to experience, to be mindful of. So that if you have prior judgments, previous, I mean, if you have made conclusions or some assumptions in advance, and then you go experience it, that's not, that's still mindfulness, but it's not upekkha oriented mindfulness, because it's not mind, your mindfulness is not set at zero, it's plus or minus, it's below zero or plus, plus zero or plus minus zero. So that is, this is one of the higher, by the way, this is one of the higher experiences, upekkha. And we will come across these things when we discuss kilesas or defilements in our future classes. Defilements, there'll be maybe, there are going to be like at least 15 classes on defilements. How could we finish discussing 1,500 basic defilements? There are 1,500 basics. I wouldn't even be able to come up with the whole list. So the last thing is sankhara upekkha jnana, this is the other word. This is even higher. This is higher than upekkha satipatthisuddhi. Upekkha satipatthisuddhi is your mindset, clear mindset, free from biases. Bias-free mindfulness that you use to experience your existence. Whereas when the fifth one, the other one is way higher than this one. That is Sankhara, SAN, diacritical mark dot underneath NKHA long A, Sankhara dash, because this is simply one phrase, Upekkha, Upekkha dash, Jnana, N with tilde, long A, NA dot underneath the second N. Sankhara, Upekkha, Jnana. Now, here, Upekkha Satipatthi is the mindset that you are supposed to have. By using Upekkha Satipatthi, that is the purity, the mindfulness, which remains pure all throughout, as it is set at zero, between zero point between joy and sorrow, and you use that mindset to your in your for your practice, in your practice, for your practice, and then you achieve something through what you achieve through Upekkha Satipatthi is Sankhara Upekkha Jnana. Now, Jnana is knowledge. Upekkha is equanimity. Sankhara is the constructions or preparations that we make. One of my favorite translations is dynamics of experience, Sankharas. Dynamics, because one experience is connected with the other experience. It's like a domino effect. You arrange the cards and flip one card and keep falling upon each other, and then finally it comes like domino effect. The domino effect doesn't end. It's unending. It's continuous. Now this is Sankhara Upekkha Jnana. Jnana is knowledge. Upekkha is equanimity, zero point between joy and sorrow. And Sankhara is the constructions or preparations. Sankhara, so the constructions of pepper. And Sak, you said something, another word, right? For Sankara, when I said that, you mentioned some other word, Sankara. You might remember later. You said, yeah, today. Not prepare. When I talked about the cake, you said, when I said Sankara, of cake Sankara, and you said something. Almost like construction or preparation, something. Fabrications, yeah. Another word, the fabrication. That's another word, fabrication. Construction, fabrication, preparation. Now, when you have Upekkha Satipatthi, meaning bias-free mindfulness to life experiences, so that your mindfulness never gets contaminated, never adulterated by your experience, so that when you continue, then you can continue to use that Upekkha Satipatthi to go through, to perceive your experiences. And that's called sankhara, means so the fabrications, constructions, or preparations. Sankhara, kaya sankhara, as we speak words, as we listen words to other people's wordings, as we do things with our body, and as we observe other people's body, as we create our own feelings and sensations, as we listen and share the feelings of other people. So we create three kinds of constructions. Verbal constructions, preparations, or fabrications, sankharas, bodily constructions, preparations, or fabrications, and mental constructions, preparations, or fabrications, three kinds of sankharas. So, and in our day-to-day life, we don't do anything else but keep creating constructions, or preparations, or fabrications of existence, sankhara. Formations too. In other words, it's a formation. Yeah, formation. Yes, thank you. Formation, construction, preparation, fabrication. These words, because we are, it is the sankharas that makes us reform ourselves, redefine ourselves. Always there's a different upananda the next moment. So that being, it's always different. I'm different right now. For example, let's say now start pronouncing the word sankhara slowly. Sankhara. When I said that, I also created some mental formations. When I said sang, I thought that the face of the bodhisattva there. Then I thought about the bodhisattvas right away. Then sankhara, by the time I said finished saying ra, I saw that the stupa, pagoda. Then I thought about, okay, then I had a cultural, all of a sudden I went to Sri Lanka and said, okay, the next time I will buy one. See, I created two different mental sankhara formations as I pronounced the word slowly. See how quick my mind was. But both times I didn't use upekkha satipada suddhi. Why is that? Because I had instantaneous, I had attachment to the bodhisattva face and also to the stupa, the replica of the stupa up there. See, that's my mind. Then after that, then at that same time, now I had another feeling that came a little bit late. Then I said, the last time I saw bodhisattva statue, I didn't like it. And I saw the stupa replica, oh, I didn't like it either. See what happened? Then I get some negative sankhara. So at that point, I didn't have upekkha sati parisuddhi. I had the bias mindfulness. Yes. Exactly, yeah. Depending on, yeah, there can be a different level of gravity between different formations based on your interests. Depends on our urges or interests, urges or needs. If it's a normal thing, it's a need, or if the urge is a deeper need, right? Let's say you have an urge for something, it's like very thirsty or something. And based on that, the depth of samskara varies from based on the level of urge or need. So let's say today you happen to sit with a co-worker that you don't like, but but it's a team for teamwork, and so that teamwork was much less impressive, not impressive at all, if I use, because still you are trying to be very positive. So you would say, instead of torturing, it would say, okay, less impressive. Whereas the next time, tomorrow, you have to work with your favorite co-worker. And that day, you don't feel the time is up, and feel like you feel so energetic that you can work long hours with your partner. There, the sankhara is more favorable sankhara. There's a favorable sankhara, but today's sankhara, the previous day sankhara was so that is agonizing and satisfying. It's called, that's why we always use a couple of words, inspiring and terrorizing. That's a couple of words that we use, inspiring and terrorizing. What used to inspire you is now terrorizing you. That's why we always battle with sankharas. Depending on, based on the moment. The only remedy is that we work out a plan to keep unpleasant people at a distance. The preventive measures is the only remedy. Or in case you have to interact with certain people that you don't like, at that point, in order to minimize the negative sankharas being created, probably you only need to stick to the professional communication. So it's then limited. Like there are certain phrases that you use to in your workplace. Nothing personal, nothing that would turn you make you closer to that partner. And we always use this in professional ethics. Sankharas, everything is sankhara, that's the problem, right? Okay, that being said, that's for today. And then so we will meet up again on May. Yeah, would you please go to, so that I can record it here. May the 11th, yeah. We will meet up again on May the 11th. Thank you very much.